Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us today to update us on the transition are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, a former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. Both of these gentlemen have been involved in the defense side of presidential transitions over the past four decades. Michael is a retired United States Army colonel, and Arnold is a retired United States Marine Corps major general. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be here, Vago.
Great to be here, Vago.
Pleasure having you on. You guys took a little bit of a hiatus because the transition scene has not been moving as quickly as we would like. Michael, talk to us a little bit about this, right? I mean, there are a large number of non-presidential appointees, Senate confirmable folks that have flooded the Pentagon for good reason, right? The administration wants to be able to put its hand on the tiller a little bit as we've been waiting for the big jobs, the next tranche of big jobs to come in. And we haven't seen any movement on that. We had an expectation a couple of weeks ago that we were going to see service secretaries as well as undersecretaries beyond Colin Call. Obviously, at this point, the only two that are in the department are Secretary Austin and Deputy Secretary Hicks. Talk to us about a little bit about where we are right now and what does this mean? And Arnold, want to get your sense on that as well.
Well, thank you, Vago. I think you started this off precisely at the right place, which is that we are 45 days since the inauguration. There are 610 days until the midterm election. And today, 3.5% of the entire first term of the Biden administration is gone. So what you've said, you're correct, that there's been a flood of non-PASs. And I think this is another unending upending of the conventional wisdom, that is not leading with the Senate confirms, but leading with these non-confirmed appointees. To me, it shows they really have their arms around the appointee challenge. It's important to remember here that the average Senate confirmed individual barely stays for 2 years, with Secretary of Defense's now at about 23 or less months on average these days, whereas the arms, the minds, and the legs of a president's team in defense, these non-confirmed people, they stay generally the full term. So these special assistants, these deputy assistants, could easily be unders or assistant secretaries in year 7 or 8 or even sooner. And it is that bench that successive previous administrations have ignored, and the results were really pretty negative. So the delay now is a separate thing in submitting the top 13 or the whole other 59 appointees of the 61 is, to me, possibly a good sign that they're in fact rethinking what they needed instead of what most campaigns do, which is politically put faces in spaces. Now they're in, they see the specific challenges to be achieved. Remember, this was slowed down by the difficulties of the transition and the lack of access they had. And they now see the specific talent that they need for specific jobs. That often necessitates a back to the drawing board. So what I see them here is rushing slowly, which is sometimes a good thing. Over.
It seems to be a little bit of a Biden hallmark, right? Rushing slowly is certainly we're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the program. Arnold, give us your sense, because all of this is playing out as the hearing cycle in the House and Senate gear up, right? The annual hearings are up. We don't know top line numbers. And the Deputy Secretary, Dr. Hicks, has launched 6 major reviews that are underway, right? So talk to us about how all of this is playing out on the legislative side of the House at a time when lawmakers also are moving ahead with obviously the stimulus package that is not going in the bipartisan fashion that I think many had hoped.
Well, Vago, I think that picking up on what you and Michael have said, we're in a very normal situation for the first year of a new administration. You know, whether the timelines ought to be quicker or not, in the last 2 or 3 administrations, they're basically within the same windows that the Bush, the Obama, and the Trump administration had for their senior DOD appointees in terms of the fact that they have the top two on board. They've got one pending in the Senate, and they haven't nominated the others of the total of 61 TASs that they need. But in the Trump administration, he didn't get his second tier, including a Secretary of the Air Force, till the end of May. And same thing in Obama. And so, secondly, the committees basically are starting their traditional hearing cycle. They're bringing in the Senate Armed Services Committee had a hearing on strategy. They're starting to hear from the combatant commanders. The House Armed Services Committee has had some similar sets of hearings. So the Armed Services Committees are not slowing down to wait on new appointees or to wait on the top line or to wait on the results of these reviews. We always knew we were going to start the year under a continuing resolution. We're not going to see the top line till, you know, early May. And obviously, it's good to be able to have it have the benefit of some of these reviews that are underway. I'm very impressed with the 80 non-PASs that they've already appointed in the Department of Defense. As Michael said, some of these people, for example, there was someone just appointed within the last week that has very impressive credentials from top line universities and industry, working in the Treasury Department. And a number of these, as Michael has said, probably would be individuals that we consider for Senate confirmed jobs later. So, and the acting, if you look at the people that are performing the duties of our acting, many of these are longtime career civilian leaders in the Pentagon, highly qualified. So I'm not one. I mean, yes, I would love to know what the numbers are. I'd love to know the names of the people that are going to be nominated to all the top jobs in the Pentagon. But I don't see the work of the Congress and I don't see the work of the Pentagon suffering right now because we don't either have the top line ready yet and we don't have the names of those people. Over.
And very briefly, Arnold, right, you mentioned budget. There has been a consensus that this will be around 740 plus or minus, but your sense is it's going to be lower, right?
I think the top line is going to be a lot closer to the FY21 actuals, which were around $708 billion for the Department of Defense 051, not the overall total national security budget. Over.
And that $708 billion is the pure defense side of the equation, right? Not all the nuclear and other spending that would bring us up to about $740 billion plus or minus. Michael, what's your sense?
Vago, I think to build on Arnold's point a little bit, there is ambiguity about the top line and the priorities of this new administration. And I'm sort of struck by what I've observed over the last couple of weeks. As we know, the national security enterprise is a constitutionally structured top-down entity. The president is the commander in chief, the secretary of defense unambiguously in charge of it. Change of administrations often include changes of direction, tone, or policy, and always shift in priorities. This is a new team that's thought about what they wanted to do if elected for four long years, and they have a very disciplined and they have a very different way of rolling that out. Wisdom would counsel typically that that the entities affected would wait patiently to hear the approach. To me, that reveal of the approach will be in the processes that have been set up, with emphasis on process of these studies. The many studies in review that are the chosen fora to determine outcomes, and wisdom would say that's where they would engage. But instead, the last 10 days, we've seen lots of demands from service chiefs, combatant commanders, MACOMs, a torrent of budget demands, and demands for top line, hardware, budget share, slush funds, and on in press meetings, interview associations, and so on, all before we have the definitive guidance of what the new team wants, how they see the world. This often is a hard way to start a process. That rush, which could effectively roll the new team with the public in the Hill, could create some long-term consequences at the expense of the better working relationship, particularly with a team that has a minimum of 4 years and maybe 8 years to go. Over.
I want to get very briefly your guys' sense. The administration put out its interim national security strategy. But importantly, Secretary Austin put out his note, two pages, short, sweet, and to the point, listed beating COVID as number one. China is the threat. Talked about the importance of cyber and, of course, investing in people. Very, very conventional message, but one that also stresses the urgency of moving faster in order to address some fast-moving threats. Very quickly, Arnold, give us your sense on this note, and Michael, want to get yours as well.
Well, Vago, this was a very important, very impressive, and very timely message from Secretary Austin, not just to the Department of Defense, but to the Congress, to the American people, and to the international scene, outlining his top three priorities with specific areas of focus. The top three are basically defend the nation, take care of our people, and succeed through teamwork. And under each of those, he has certain priorities. For example, defend COVID. You mentioned China. Innovate and modernize the DOD. He focuses on talent and diversity. He understands we need alliance and partners. And this is his equivalent of Mattis's three priorities. And it's changed from those, as you would expect. And it's a very useful document for people that follow national security so they can understand, very consistent with the strategy put out by President Biden, very consistent with all the things that we predicted President Biden would do, and the Pentagon is following that. He talks also about the fact that we need to close the strategy force mismatch, which is very, very important because we know we're not going to have the resources to implement the national defense strategy the way that was outlined in the previous administration. And he's going to close that gap. There's not enough emphasis, in my view, on defense reform. And also, it doesn't talk any about industry and the role of industry, which is also very important. But I'm sure that will be coming down the road. Over.
Michael?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with Arnold. I mean, this is not Mattis Trump. It is powerful, crisp, and to the point. But I think, remarkably, it ends not with a command, but with a plea. If I can quote Secretary Austin, I hope you will consider how you can assist in this effort. So, as Arnold said, there are no surprises. We heard much of this in the campaign, but it is somewhat remarkable to see it all in a letter to the force. And I agree with Arnold. If their budget and the later NDS reflects this, as I expect it will, this is going to be a material shift. This is really a different team with a different set of priorities.
Guys, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Have a terrific weekend and a terrific week, and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Looking forward to some sunshine.
Always a pleasure, Vago. Always a pleasure.
And joining us now for our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington are Dr. Gordon Adams, a fellow with the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center, and professor emeritus at American University, Dr. Patrick Cronin of the Hudson Institute, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many roles is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
Always a pleasure.
Good to be back.
Thank you all for joining us again. Mackenzie, why don't you start us off on the budget discussion? At the top of the program, we heard Arnold tell us a $708 billion number. To put that into context, that is what the Pentagon number is. That doesn't include nuclear and other government agency spending. The expectation has been that the overall number is going to be around $740 billion, plus or minus a couple of billion dollars. At the end of the day, now that we've heard from the administration and its the interim national security strategy and Secretary Austin's guidance that put COVID as sort of the number one national security priority, but China as the threat, then talked about climate, then talked about investing in people, which suggests more military benefits. What is the impact in your mind, right, as we've been having this rolling conversation about what the impact will be on weapon programs?
So I think it's important what you just said, and we've talked about this on previous roundtables, that there are priorities for the Pentagon, and then there are the threats and challenges that they're going to confront. And in this case, you know, there is some divergence, you know, that is sort of, it's cumulative, right? And so pandemic relief and response is priority number one, and the pacing threat is China. And when they rack and stack it, it goes pandemic and China. And so, you know, that calls for additional spending underneath the top line, right? So there's not going to be new money based on what the always knowledgeable Arnold Pinheiro is hearing, and others from OMB passed back last week, the guidance to the department. And so we're looking at a $3 to $5 billion shift from basically 21 numbers to 22 for the president, as in reduction. Now, that's not a big reduction year over year, but it is a big cut when you look at what President Trump had proposed for FY22. And of course, he's not president, but it still gives you a sense of where the Pentagon was planning and potentially for the future. And that's about a $20 billion difference between where Trump would have been for either of those top lines, with or without nuclear weapons, and where it's going to come out. So it's probably $20 to $24 billion delta, if we're talking the overall defense spending dollar figure. And then, like I said, you have to sort of reprioritize investments underneath the top line, not just for COVID, but also for climate change. And the department, historically, these are big spending amounts potentially, right? It depends on what you want to do. If this is more about bases, or if it's more about war games and war plans, or if it's more about disaster and humanitarian relief, it's probably a combination of all three. So it's going to have some of that bloodletting effect that Chairman Milley talked about. It'll affect Army and strength, but I think first and foremost, it'll hit procurement the hardest. Not in a 2010 Robert Gates fashion, but still some effect.
Gordon, let me bring you into the conversation. You obviously mentored a lot of folks who've gone into this administration. What's your sense about where we are on the numbers? And one of the things the administration is talking about is the urgency of making decisions that we have delayed for too long, right? To make those hard choices. They do talk about pressures on the budget, as Mackenzie just mentioned, but there's also the sense that doing so politically will be very, very difficult, right? I mean, these positions, as we heard from Arnold and Michael, are not yet being filled. And so you have a finite clock with a razor-thin margin for Democrats in the House and Senate, right? It's not going to be popular to tell everybody, hey, we're going to cut all of these programs, even if we need to cut those programs, right? Where do we end up as a number? And are we, especially since Democratic members are starting to get irritated with the administration, does any sort of big lift look like it's likely in the future, even if the president thinks that there should be? Because I'm told by a number of sources, the president sort of gets it. He knows we have to make some big movements if we want to keep deterring China, for example.
Yeah, I think it seems to me from this number, and it's consistent with numbers that I was hearing last week, we're within $2 or $3 billion of flat, either without inflation or with inflation, depending on how you measure it. And it's a Goldilocks number politically. It's a Goldilocks number because it's neither too much nor too little politically. Mike Rogers and the minority in the House Armed Services Committee sent a letter to the president saying, give us our 3 to 5% real growth. The left in the Democratic Party is saying, give us 10% cuts. And the president has chosen a political Goldilocks. It's basically right somewhere in the middle where, hopefully, I think from the White House's perspective, this is not going to be a contentious number. They don't want to fight over the defense budget. And so I've always expected them to come in right around where most of us on this program have been talking for months now, which is about flat. So politically, it's astute. Right. It's going to disappoint the progressives and Democratic Party. It's going to make Mike Rogers and the Republicans and Inhofe jump up and down about how we're sacrificing American national security, which means typically, especially in a Democratic administration, and I did serve in one, that's the Goldilocks number that allows you to be politically a little bit safer. And this administration doesn't want a fight over the defense number. They want to fight over the COVID bill. They want to fight over the next budget resolution and what they're going to do about infrastructure, climate change, COVID. That's the political agenda for the administration. So I'm not at all surprised that this is the number. It will disappoint some people. It will, and I think Mackenzie's right here, it's going to lead to what we've always been talking about, which is a steady pressure on the department to set some choices. So Kath Hicks has laid out 5 or 6 areas, including the nuclear enterprise, as to what they're going to adjust and deal with the number that they obviously were expecting to get. and they'll make some hardcore decisions about that. You know, and I expect there to be pressure on the nuclear programs. There's going to be pressure. I think end strength is clearly in the Army one of the areas. There's a lot of language, not only there, but in Secretary Austin's memorandum, March 4th, to the department, that says we're going to do something about legacy platforms. And we've been hearing this for months now, legacy platforms. So there's going to be some cutting and trimming around things, God knows what, A-10, CH-47, whatever they're going to define as a legacy program is going to be something that pays the price on this. And the big bill payer in terms of out-year planning, and it's absolutely right that the department internally in the services has been planning to a higher growth number, and they're going to have to scale some of that plan back. And that affects the number of ships being bought per year by the Navy. The Navy appetite, which has been large, is going to have to be constrained under this number. So there will be some real choices that need to be made. It's not draconian. It is, in my judgment, completely manageable. But it's going to require bearing down on some of the issues that Kathics and Secretary Austin have raised.
Dov, why don't you give us your sense? You were a former Pentagon comptroller. You know, how this budget dance will go, and your thoughts on what the interim national security strategy and Austin's letter was, you know, regarding the interim strategy. A friend of mine put it, it's really, you know, it has some things good on it. For example, that the president sort of gets the need to make major muscle movements. On the other hand, it was more of a document to say we put a document out, right? Without any disrespect to those people who put it together. What's your sense on that?
Well, there are a number of things here. First, the document, let me put it this way. The Austin memo tracks with the document. One of the things about this document is it did list priorities. It's just to some people, these are unusual priorities. It has redefined national security in terms of climate change, for example, obviously in terms of the pandemic. Hard to argue with that. Those are national security priorities, but it's very, very expansive. And it talks about a lot of purely domestic issues and arguing that unless we fix those domestic issues, we threaten our national security. Given that these domestic issues have been around since well before the Second World War, it's not clear how they threaten our national security. So it's clearly a rushed document that's been, in fact, it was so rushed that they mislabeled New Zealand as a partner instead of an ally. But those two big priorities, the pandemic and climate change, turn out to be Secretary Austin's priorities. And as Mackenzie said, given that we all agree that the budget is going to be flat, those priorities mean there's going to be even more pressure on the rest of the budget, which brings me to the personnel side. I was on the Military Compensation Commission, and we put out a booklet. It's really a book of several hundred pages of benefits. Now, here's the thing. If you cut those benefits, you're going to affect recruiting at the same time that you already probably are going to be much more careful about whom to recruit because of what happened on January 6th and the role of veterans. You don't want to cut back on recruiting to the point that you have to go back to where it was in the 70s. So cutting benefits is one thing. Not adding to them is a different thing. And I think that is where the administration really is going. They will not add to benefits, even if they've said something like that in the national security strategy. Even by not doing that, there's going to be, as I think we all agree on this program, a pressure on legacy systems. And I think that beyond those that have been mentioned, Gordon briefly talked about the Navy. There are people on the Navy staff who really do believe that the only way for them to get out of their conundrum is to go after the Ford program. The Ford carrier is so far delayed and so far overcost that it really begs the question of how many more of these do you want? Lots of questions about the littoral combat ship. Look at what happened to the Zumwalt class. It stopped after three. They have had trouble. And so they need and they want unmanned and partially manned ships. And the only way they're going to get them, and that is the cutting edge, and Kath Hicks points in that direction as well, the only way they'll get them is by getting rid of some of the big stuff. And that is going to be very painful indeed.
You know, those who are involved with those programs would say, hey, look, you know, we're trying to develop a new generation of warship. And in Ford's case, right, I mean, it was an ambitious program. Folks warned against don't put everything in it, and it would be a challenge. And alas, we find ourselves here. And, you know, if Mike Petters from Huntington Ingalls was here, he'd tell you, well, if you just can get the run rate higher, eventually it'll work itself out cost-wise, right? I mean, the lead ship, especially an ambitious one, always tends to be a little bit higher. But I take your point. It a lot of the Navy budget is going to it at a time when people are questioning the future of the aircraft.
And remember, and let me add, that the first priority of the Navy budget is not the Ford carrier. It's the new ballistic missile submarine, Columbia. Absolutely. So that's even more pressure.
Gordon, you have a quick point you want to add about the Austin and the interim national security strategy. Go ahead, and then Mackenzie, want to come to you before I go to Patrick for some. He's been very patient to give us to be the discussant on China, given there's so much going on. Go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah, on the national security strategy, it is a kind of kitchen soup document, a classic one for administrations, I have to say, particularly Democratic administrations. Almost every issue or country that you want in there is in there, New Zealand mislabeled notwithstanding. So I was teasing for clues here, if there are any clues here. No blank check on the Middle East, foreshadows where we may be going and consistent with the Saudi things. Nuke programs supposed to be safe, secure, and effective. That's code language for we're going to give the nuke programs most of the money that they've requested. Both the Austin document and the national security strategy, thematic continuity here, emphasize diplomacy first, diplomacy first, diplomacy first, no forever wars. And there's, as is expected, particularly given Jake Sullivan's predilections, a lot of attention here to the domestic economy, trade issues, the relationship with China economically. You know, there's a big piece here that is basically consistent with we've got to clean up our own house before we can clean up to the world. And it's entirely consistent within the Austin memorandum as well. The right themes are picked up, the right priorities are put down. I don't think it tells us an awful lot when rubber hits the road where the choices are going to be made here. And I think the legacy programs in the Navy and the Army end strength are going to be the three big targets in looking at long-term planning and defense, pretty much regardless of where the rhetoric is going in either document.
Mackenzie, let me bring you in on the conversation about, and I want to get everybody's comment very briefly on this because I'm cognizant of our time. And I know, Mackenzie, you've got to leave us here in a couple of minutes. Mackenzie, I want to ask you about the political dynamic at play here. The administration was expected to put relations with Congress and bipartisanship front and center. There was that expectation. But increasingly, the administration has been annoying even the senior-most Democrats. Adam Smith and Jack Reed, the House and Senate Armed Services Committee chairman, respectively, said, we really look forward to seeing Michelle Flournoy. We don't want a four-star general. They got Austin without a lot of consultation beforehand, catching them a little off guard and forcing both of them to backtrack. No senior politician likes to do that. Even very patient ones like Reed and Smith. And then we heard from Tim Kaine saying, hey, look, we've got to rescind the authorization of military force that was enacted some two decades ago, because I don't need to find out about a serious strike from news media. I needed to hear about it from the White House beforehand. And now you're hearing from the White House that they may be willing to do that. Is this something that is a damaging political dynamic for this administration going forward, when it seems to be undermining relations with key members of its own party?
I don't know about damaging, but it's going to make the job harder unnecessarily, right? So the White House didn't have to do that. Now, there's word in the press that President Biden called off a second strike in Syria, and that may make some people happy for humanitarian reasons, which I would agree with, I guess. But, I think the Keynes and the Smiths of the world will, you know, it's not going to stop them from voting with the White House or with the party on key priorities. And of course, this morning, there's also additional reporting that the White House agrees with Senator Kaine's push. Now, I don't know how much of that is just sort of kumbaya for the moment. And when it comes down to whipping an actual bill and a vote, you know, that's a different story. But that's something, you know, significant. I would say that's the first White House in 20 years to say any indication of change in terms of authorization and reigning in the executive's powers. But it's going to make everything more challenging. If you watch the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing this week for the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy nominee, you know, it was a lot of there was a lot of back and forth between the two parties that, you know, a couple of years ago, Democrats, you said that Anthony Tata couldn't move forward for the exact same reasons. Republicans are now saying that Dr. Colin Call can't move forward. And so there was a lot of bickering and it wasn't a great dynamic. If you add to all of this, you know, legacy cuts of the kind Dove and Gordon are referring to, specifically potentially Ford class, littoral combat ship that you raised, but also, you know, we're going to see more proposals to retire cruisers, to retire A-10s, to retire Army helicopters, to retire Marine Corps additional Hornets, you know, older DDG-51s even. So there's going to be a lot in there that's going to upset everybody. So now you've like sort of added, piled on to the fight ahead, and that's just going to make everything more difficult in terms of getting a bill enacted on time, which was already going to be hard enough.
Dove, why don't you give us your sense, because you have been talking to senior Democrats over the course of the week about whether they're irritated or not and what the implications are. And right, Neera Tanden's been withdrawn and there are some concerns whether Colin Call is going to make it through at the end of the day. And if he doesn't, right, you always want the policy chief of the Pentagon, who is the external face of the department, to at least have some bipartisan chops to them, right? I mean, you don't want a partisan vote on that as a general rule, but hey, right? I mean, conventions are kind of out the door here over the last couple of years. Give us your sense.
Well, a couple of things. First, yeah, I've been in touch with a couple of senior Democratic senators, and I didn't get the sense from either of them that regardless of the serious strike and the Austin choice, that they're, I think McKenzie's right, they're not going to back away from Biden. And Biden's smart enough, and that's what the press report is all about, to know that he shouldn't make it so difficult for them that they find themselves forced to back away. The Colin Call thing is different. Call has a reputation that not only a lot of Republican senators get uneasy about, but actually some Democratic senators on the moderate side aren't entirely comfortable with as well. My guess is that he will get in, but, you know, to get in with the vice president's vote, as you say, is not going to be helpful to him over the long run. There will be resentment there. More generally, I think Biden, by pulling Neera Tanden, people are calling it a defeat. I don't call it a defeat. It happens to every president. I think it's a matter of prudence. And one thing Biden, I think, has shown, particularly on the foreign policy, national security side, is that he really is prudent. They're being very, very careful. And so if he makes a misstep, he seems to correct it pretty quickly.
Patrick has been very patient, but Gordon, I'm going to give you very briefly, talk to us about what Colin did say to the Senate Armed Services Committee regarding arms exports and the human rights records of the nations who should be receiving them, right? That arms sales should reflect values at the end of the day, which this administration has said, even as it tries, I think, as Dove was trying to say, have a very realpolitik approach to the way that it goes about doing things. Give us that sense, because we do have to move on to China.
Well, it's a huge tension in the American military and civilian diplomatic engagement overseas, is who we sell arms to, how we sell the arms. And it is probably one of the areas of policy that has gotten the least amount of oversight and scrutiny in the entire overseas engagement of the United States. And many of these are political payoff programs. Some of our walking around money for ambassadors. It distorts embassy programs to have big arms sales or security cooperation activity. Tends to have a negative effect on the country in which those programs have been received. The Brown Costs of War program right now has a new report out on how American security cooperation and arms transfers have affected politics in Burkina Faso and Africa, for example. It's not clear these programs bias security. So it really is a moment, I think it was, I'm glad he foreshadowed it, for a full-scale review of how we do this, who we provide arms to, who we do security cooperation with, and what is the evaluation. Most of these programs have never had a performance evaluation done with them in any administration, Democratic or Republican. So it kind of sent up a very interesting signal to me. Congress is going to be concerned about it because they're always concerned politically, particularly about arms sales. So it'll be very interesting if he's confirmed to see how that plays itself out.
Patrick, you have been exceptionally patient. Thanks very much for waiting your turn on this very big week for China in terms of major themes, obviously a major party conference at which Xi has said, right, 6.5% growth. This is a man who got a lifetime term in part to stick it to the United States, crush democracy in Hong Kong and take back Taiwan. He's batting 2 out of 3. And we heard from Admiral Phil Davidson, the Indo-Pacific commander at a great event at AEI yesterday that most anybody who was interested in China listened to, at which the admiral made clear that we have a 5-year window to keep deterring China, that China does want to replace and upend the global order, and that $24 billion of investment is going to be needed to build Pacific capabilities, among them, for example, putting Aegis ashore on Guam, freeing up 3 destroyers for other important work in the region. Start us off with what's going on in Beijing right now. What's the tone we're hearing? Because Beijing has been ratcheting up pressure on Taiwan, right? It even boils down to pineapples, right? 90% of Taiwan's pineapples go to the mainland, and that's been suspended because Beijing didn't like, you know, criticism that it was hearing from Taipei. Give us a sense on what's going on in Beijing and what the stakes are.
Sure. Well, Vago, to set the context, you've got the Biden administration trying to defeat COVID so they can get to the point where they want to outcompete and keep their pacing challenge of China and kind of beat them out in the longer run. Xi, meanwhile, is trying to consolidate and leverage his advantages right now, his political advantages, so he can extend his lead and surpass the United States, keep China on the trajectory of becoming the primary power in the world. So you've got the 2 sessions underway in terms of the People's Conference and the Consultative Conference. These are 5,000 delegates, rubber stamp Congress and advisories, advisors on the politics, coming to basically embrace the Xi agenda. During this CCP, Chinese Communist Party centenary year, en route to the Olympics and en route to the next year's Party Congress, where Xi, as you say, has a life term already, so he's going to get extended for a 3rd term. So this is all about his ascendancy and keeping this power. He has 2 messages. One of them is the economic message, that he has led China to defeat COVID faster than any other power in the world, and now he is going to sustain China's economic development on toward primacy, where they become a $30 trillion economy by 2035. The backstory there is, though, you've got this paranoia about Hong Kong protests. So if you're such a great dominant power, why is it that student protesters in Hong Kong create such an obsession? And so there's a contradiction going on that they're not talking about in China, where the rhetoric is all in support of the Xi agenda, Xi thought. You then have this political story that he wants to sell. Xi is selling the triumph of an authoritarian system. And this techno-authoritarian system is going to invest heavily in things like third-generation semiconductors so they can leapfrog ahead of the current technological advantage of the United States and the West. And that's where the Biden administration wants to not wait for us to defeat COVID, not wait for us to build back better, but to start working even today to signal both the conventional deterrence is going to hold in this decade, this critical decade that Admiral Davidson is talking about, but also we're going to be able to outcompete technologically in the coming decades with new investments and innovation. So, you know, the expeditionary advanced base operations, which essentially is what Admiral Davidson is talking about in the first island chain, is going to be the way that we have our own anti-access and area denial capability to keep China deterred from adventurism and keep them in the gray zone so that they don't leap from the gray zone to this conventional use of force that could signal game over, system change. China is now in charge of order. The United States has to retreat. Allies can't depend on the United States. The Biden administration is pushing hard diplomatically. So you have President Biden meeting virtually next Friday on the 12th with his 3 counterparts of this quadrilateral security dialogue with India, Japan, and Australia. You have him backed up with European navies. All G7 navies will be in the South China Sea this year, other than Italy, which is incredible. The Germans are joining, UK sending a carrier, of course, France is there. You have a 2+2, the first 2+2 with Japan. So you've got the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State going to Japan on the 15th and meeting with their Japanese counterparts to kind of reinforce the broad political, economic, technological, and military agenda here. You have a lot of activity going on. China is indeed the pacing challenge. We can't wait to defeat COVID before we start to deal with it. That's why you start to see things like the interim national security strategic guidance come out of the White House, because we are now doing open, transparent, simultaneous drafts of strategy in front of the American people. That's why there are errors in that document. It's just a placeholder to say, look, we're going to have to keep running on several different tracks at the same time.
In terms of the messages that Admiral Davidson was delivering, right? I mean, if you look at how much money he's asking for, right? I mean, there's always a tendency in Washington for people to cry foul. But actually, the amount of money that he actually has is remarkably small. And one of the frustrating elements of this is not to speak on his behalf or put words on anybody in his staff's mouth, right? There are some pressing needs that Pacific commanders have been talking about for a long time, whether for weaponry or shoreside investment, that actually has been very slow in being enacted, right? Much to everybody's frustration. I mean, these are small investment dollars, but actually big impacts. Is there a sense on your part that America's most important military commander and his successor, obviously he's stepping down a little bit later this summer in Lung Aquilino, the Pacific Fleet commander is said to be the next guy up in the seat, as is the traditional pattern. What's your sense, right? Or, I mean, do you get a sense that people understand that this investment is critical?
I think there is consensus. If you can go back to the latest Pew poll, 90% of Americans see China as either a competitor or an enemy. Congress is supporting a bipartisan bill on the democracy technology partnership to try to maintain technological leadership. I think you'll have strong support for this Pacific deterrence initiative that Admiral Davidson has outlined, some $5 billion a year over the next 5 or 6 years to try to build out these capabilities. Is it enough? I don't know if it's enough, but it's a good start in terms of the direction we want to go. And if we can mobilize enough allies and partners to work strategically, we can do a lot here in the next 5 or 6 years, not just to deter conventional use of force against, say, Taiwan, which I think we can deter, but we do have to work at it. But also we can even start to discipline China in the gray zone. That is, we start to make them have imposed costs on their activities as they try to do things like, say, open up a naval base in the Gulf of Thailand at Riam, where Cambodia is reportedly given the PLA access. That gives the Chinese closer access to the Strait of Malacca. It gives them a certain advantage in terms of Taiwan scenarios. That's the kind of thing, the dynamic that we're going to be watching. These events are going to roll out. It's not just going to be these announcements this month. It's going to be what else China does that they're not talking about in Beijing at these great political two sessions. What are they actually going to be doing with their PLA, with their maritime militia and other forces? So is it enough? Watch this space. There's strong bipartisan consensus, I think, on China. And I think growing international support. I think the Europeans are the most interesting case here, because they are starting slowly but surely to see that their interests, their long-term interests, are in helping a free and open Indo-Pacific with the United States, with Asian Pacific countries.
We've got 30 or so seconds left. Dov, I want to give you the last word, in part because I think we do need to talk about Iran and what we're hearing from Tehran, right? Some openness to have a conversation, to resume nuclear talks, assuming that they can get word in about a year whether or not sanctions are going to be lifted. The administration, as we discussed, did face a little bit of criticism about the strike. There's been another Iranian-backed militia strike on al-Assad. The Biden administration hasn't responded yet. I'm beginning to call this the Biden balance on how it moves to do things in sort of a realpolitik way, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we still have to deal with Saudi Arabia. We still have to deal with Russia, maintain opportunities to escalate. Don't go high and right right away. Are we on the right track? Is the administration on the right track with Iran at this point? Or is it sending the wrong messages?
No, I don't think they're sending the wrong messages. You know, Lloyd Austin told the president, look, you can choose the timing. And the Iranians, I think, are discovering that they're not the only ones who can play chess, even if they invented it. The fact of the matter is, I don't think they thought Biden would ever strike back. I think they thought Biden and his team would come running to the table because they had dealt with most of that team before. And it's turning out that that's just not the case. And what their worry is, I think, and it might even be bothering the hardliners, is that unless they turning over some of their cards, as it were, then they would find themselves under these extreme sanctions that Biden has not said he's taking yet, away yet. So I think they are reconsidering their position, and they put out this teaser. Yes, well, maybe give us, you know, if you give us a year or something like that, or we'll give you a year. It's all talk, but that's how they operate. And they're sizing Biden up and discovering that maybe he's not the guy they thought he was.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. An absolute pleasure as always. Have a great weekend and a great week. Looking forward to having you back on and looking forward to dig a little bit deeper in Afghanistan. We didn't talk about that as much, and some of the discussions, obviously, the administration is having about the future of U.S. Troops there, you know, and whether or not this administration is going to stick to the Trump plan. Thanks very much again.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.